I'm Wallace, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Wallace.
I was checking out this podium for a reason. Everybody's been here at this conference. They've been so nice to me, and I really appreciate it. And I'm not ready for any more surprises. So I checked out this podium, and those of you who saw Police Academy number 2, you know what I'm talking about. And those of you who did not see it, you can ask somebody. I'm not going to tell you. But it is a real thrill and a pleasure to be here this morning and to celebrate the miracle of recovery. And as Cliff so marvelously said last night, it's what it is. A celebration of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anytime I'm in an area like this, at a convention like this, to me this is a celebration of sobriety. My real ability and endeavor in life is to carry the message of recovery within the confines of my home group and whenever, wherever anyone reaches out for help. And it's one of the reasons that I'm very, very actively involved in correctional facility work. And certainly hope that many, many of you are doing that. My sobriety date is February 16th, 1964. And I'm truly grateful that God in His infinite mercy gave me one more shot at life whereby I could find a decent way of life and have a lifestyle that I never dreamed possible, because the type of drunk that I am, I doubt if many of you have gone there. And when I was called and asked to come down here, the person that called me had heard me before. They knew that I was a low-bottom drunk, and they said, "We want you to come to Atlanta." They have never seen one. So, here I am. I do want to thank the committee for being so nice. A fantastic gift bag was in the room, and it was the nicest gift bag I've ever seen at any convention I've been to. And one of the things I got a kick out of was these little sticks.
Yeah.
They were holding the goodies up. But when I first saw it, I said, now, the people in Georgia are sort of like the people in Texas. Out Texas, I had passed an ostrich farm many, many years ago, and I asked my host, "What kind of chickens are they?" Because everything is bigger and better in Texas. And out in Las Vegas once, some guys were wanting to take me to the bunny farm. And I said, "We have enough rabbits around home." So when this stick was in that bag yesterday, I figured that this was a Georgia toothpick. And I must save it. It is good to be here, and I appreciate the committee asking me and all of the nice correspondence that I had from Ann and the phone calls and emails from those of you who are on the committee. It's been a real deal for me, and I'm truly grateful for it. No way can I say thank you enough. I do appreciate Bob meeting me. See, he run off and left me now. At the airport, and it will be his responsibility to see that I get back this afternoon. And I know that my wife wants to see me, and I'm confident my little dog will want to see me. She won't eat the first day after I leave. My wife told me last night that she started eating again yesterday evening. So she'll be glad to see me, and I'll be glad to see both of those girls too. They're fine folks. I hardly know where to start this morning because the speakers that we have had this weekend, I've heard Cliff many, many times. I've loved that old bald-headed joker for many, many years, and his wife too. He's not getting any better looking, but he sure isn't getting better than carrying the message. I tell you, that was one of the most fantastic, enjoyable talks last night I've ever heard. Cliff Roach May, and I told him so. And Tina and Bobby, I met Tina for the first time this weekend, and it's a delightful experience meeting her and George. And Bobby, I tell you, he can talk so fast, I can't listen that fast. But you won't have that trouble with me. You can tell that I'm from the North by the way I talk. I am an alcoholic, and I have been one probably since I was 20 years old. I made a choice to drink, but I certainly did not make a choice in becoming an alcoholic. I was a little bit different from the so-called social drinker. I'm one of those people that when I put booze in my system, it immediately changed the way I felt. And there's one thing about my behavior when I put booze in my system. You could always predict that it would be unpredictable. I never knew what I'd get: fighting liquor, crying liquor, stealing liquor, loving liquor, sleeping liquor, or what. Something was going to happen. Because I'm just one of those people that had a real adverse reaction to booze. And I think that I was screwed up somewhat before I ever took my first drink of whiskey, because I'm from a little bit flaky family in some ways. We were very, very poor people growing up in Roxburgh, North Carolina. I have six brothers, five brothers and myself, and six other sisters. And Mom and Dad finally found out what was causing it, and they quit. My dad said once that we lived in that cotton mill village where all of the houses were alike, and that our house was down near the railroad track with no underpinning under it. And when that old train would come by that was very close to the house, at 4 o'clock in the morning and blow that whistle, it would wake everybody up. And he said that at 4 o'clock in the morning, it's too late to go back to sleep and too early to get up, and it ended up being 12 of us. And I'm the baby boy. It was rough in the early days of my childhood because we were poor. We lived in the cotton mill village until I was about 4 years old, and then we moved out on the farm. We farmed from then until I was 16. And I didn't like being on the farm. I didn't like work. I started work in the field when I was 5 years old and did that up until I was 16 on that farm. And Mom and Dad did the best that they could with us. I was just flaky from the start. I felt bad about myself as a kid. I was very skinny. Even when I grew up into teenage status, I felt bad about being skinny. I didn't like to go swimming down at the pond where other guys and gals would be swimming because I looked like a crane. I was so skinny. In fact, people said that I had a sister so skinny that she swallowed an olive and 2 men left tank. But I wasn't quite that skinny, but I did feel bad about myself. And I've been spiritually sick since I was a kid. I didn't like going to church with Mom and Dad because they would go Wednesday night, Sunday morning, Sunday night. About every 3 or 4 weeks, it seemed to me they'd have a revival, and then it would be every night. And I never felt in church the way they acted as if they felt. I had much rather been outside playing or doing something else. And I had a brother. My older brother stayed at home until he was 21 years old, and that was customary around home in those days. You became a free man at 21, and my brother stayed home and passed over his cotton mill check to my father every week. until he was 21 years old. He left home at 21 years of age with a seventh grade education and went off down to South Carolina, got in school, began working down there. He finished his middle school, got in high school, went on to college, eventually became a doctor of divinity. And as a kid, I didn't like that brother. He'd come home and pray, and Mom would fix up a big dinner, the biggest dinner she'd ever have, and he would say grace, and it would take him forever. This was back during World War II, and I remember it. I'm 6 years old or so, and he would start praying. He'd pray for Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt and General MacArthur, all the boys in Okinawa and Iwo Jima, Germany. Pray for all my aunts and uncles. And it was 17 on Mama's side and 12 of us. And by the time he got through praying, the food would be cold. On one occasion, when my brother was saying grace, he'd gotten down to about Aunt Lucy. And I had looked down and seen that fried chicken there, and I picked up me a piece of that chicken, and I'm standing at the corner of the table. There's nowhere for me to sit with everybody there. My father's over here, and I'm standing at the corner of the table. I pick that chicken up, and I start working on it. And I mean, I feel stripped that, Jesse. It was good. I hadn't had the chicken in a long time. And he got down to about Aunt Lucy then, and I looked down. I'm going to ease that bone back into the plate so my daddy won't hear it. My fingers were greasy, and that chicken bone slipped out of my plate hand and hit that plate. It sounded like a dinner bell ring. And my father grabbed me right in the crotch and by the nape of the neck, and out behind the smokehouse we went. He pulled my pants down, got him a dogwood switch, and he wore my fanny out. He wore it out good fashion. Disrespect to my brother. You can bet your bottom dollar, Wallace never, ever, ever even thought about eating another piece of chicken while my brother was praying. I learned from that one experience. And when I look at my life later on over the years, time after time after time, I go out and get to drinking, getting drunk, getting in trouble, and not once would I learn a lesson. I was always thoroughly convinced that this time I'll do it right. This time I'll quit at 11 o'clock. This time I won't get in a fight. This time I won't run my mouth. This time I won't go to jail. But it did not happen. I could not learn that I could not handle booze, and I tried with all my heart and soul. When my preacher brother started giving me man-to-man talks, I really and truly hated him then. It was so disgusting. He was using words. One of them had course to it, and I didn't know what he was talking about. If he had used some four-letter words, I'd have probably understood him. But one time he had me down behind the barn, and I'm 14 years old, and he's about ready to go back to South Carolina to his ministry. And it seemed to me with his college education that he always talked down. Wallace, I want to warn you, if you ever drink that white whiskey, if you ever run with those naughty girls, or you ever play with yourself, you're going to hell. And I thought about that for a minute that evening, and I ain't never had no white whiskey. I ain't never had a chance to be with a naughty girl. But heck, I'm already in trouble. I made up my mind he'd never get me behind that barn again. And he didn't. He didn't. He never gave me another man-to-man talk. When I'm 16 years old, my father made an announcement one Sunday morning. He stood up very, very proudly saying, when we get this crop of tobacco in, we're going to quit farming. He says, I have had enough. I'm 16 years old, and I'd had enough, too. I can tell you, I had hated working before school, working after school, working all during summer months. Other kids would be at the golf course or down at the lake playing, and I wanted to be there, too, but I couldn't. I had been tied down on that farm and had missed a lot of school. And I was really looking forward to finishing up that tobacco crop and getting it harvested where we'd be through with it. I knew, too, when he made that announcement that Sunday morning, that I'd be through feeding those mules, unmilking those cows, and working in that tobacco field. And Lord, did I hate that mule. I don't know how in the world people out west make it when they were riding horses and so forth. I hate mules until today. I got a tiller at home. But that mule that I had to plow when I'm a small kid and had to reach up to get the plow handles and hold it, I hated her with a passion. She was the longest, tallest, ugliest, skinniest, most ornery mule I had ever seen. And I hated her because she hated me. I'd be plowing behind her, and I declare she would break wind and look back at me and grin. And I said I'd never tell another mule to get up as long as I live, not even if she sat down in my lap, and I have. That's why I've got a tiller at home today. My father did not force me to go back to school. I've hated it many, many times, but he did not force me to go back to school. I had a driver's license then, but I couldn't drive. He wouldn't let me drive his car unless I was running an errand. I'm 16 years old, ready to go, but nothing to drive. He says, if you want to drive, you'll buy your car. You'll go to work and buy it. And at 17, I had that. At 17, I became popular for the first time. The older boys began to run with me. They began drinking beer. They were 19 or 20, some of them. Some of them were 18. They began drinking beer, and it wasn't long before they encouraged me to join in with them, and I didn't like it. For the next 2 years, I did sip a little beer. But I certainly did not like it. I did not feel the effect of it. It made me nauseous. I knew why they had all those Budweiser horses around. I did not like it. And I would pour out a lot of good beer for that first 2 years. I didn't want those guys to know I was drinking so little. But that changed in 1953. I'm 19 years old then. I'm drafted into the Army. The Korean War is in progress. I'm sent off down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, for basic training. And I stay there for 12 weeks, and then they transfer me to Fort Lee, Virginia. And in November of 1953, I came home from Fort Lee to Roxburgh, North Carolina, where I was born and raised. And I'm out at a round and square dance, a room about half as large as this room here, one Saturday night. A dance I had been to a couple of times before, going into the service. But I had never danced. I had never felt like dancing. But I'm out at that dance that Saturday night, had on my Army OD uniform. This is in November. And I had some little pins up on the corner of the shoulders to make it look a little bit dressier. I also had on all of the medals I'd earned that afternoon at the PX at Fort Lee before I came home. And I'm standing over at the heater minding my own business and just doing what I did when I was out in a gathering like that. I'm watching other people have a good time. Watching people laugh, talk, dance, socialize, get the chasers, go out to the cars, get the drinks, and I'm just standing there. The two guys I had come out there with were over there, a little bit to my right, talking with some girls, and I wanted so much to talk with those girls and get up and dance like they did, and I could not. I didn't feel like it. I didn't know how to dance. And besides, they wouldn't answer me anyway. I'm afraid. But I look over toward the concession stand and the front door there. And when I'm looking that way, I see two tremendous protrusions coming that door. I mean, they were attached to a beautiful woman. And they came in the door a long time before she did. And when she got in that door, she immediately started across that floor toward that heater, and everything was just a-bouncing in unison. All the way across that floor, I had never seen them before in my life, but I immediately recognized them because of some stories I'd heard in pool rooms and service stations and beer joints. I'd heard some stories that would almost curl your hair. And she was headed straight toward the heater. I thought maybe she might be cold. But she zeroed in on me, and she started talking to me, and I'm restless, ill at ease, and discontent. From what my brother had told me, this might be one of those naughty girls. And from what I've heard, I was pretty convinced that she was. Anyway, she talked with me a little bit, and I'm embarrassed. And I was delighted in just a few minutes when she suggested I escort her out to her car. You know, it might be some wolves in the parking lot. And I'm right out of basic training. I got my medals on. Maybe it's my patriotic duty. So I do it. I escort her out to that car that cold November night. And she got in that old Chevrolet, and it sputtered a little bit when she tried to start it up. She got it going. She turned the radio on to WCKY Cincinnati 1 Ohio, that country and western music. And in those days, that old Chevrolet, the heater was way over here in front of the passenger's knees. You know about that. And she had to reach up under there to get that button to get it going. And while she's over there, she began to peck up on this side of my neck and ear and try to get me going. And I'm calling the old Chevrolet. Anyway, she did that for a little bit, and I'm getting restless, ill at ease, and more discontent, and getting upset. These things that I had heard began to flash through my head. The warnings I had heard from my brother began to flash through my head. I began to look at her, and I began to listen to what she was saying and suggesting, and feeling the effects of that nibbling on my neck and squeezing me, and I'm getting upset. I ain't never experienced nothing like this. I tell you, she had two cups there in her hand a minute. She got out from under her seat. Then she reached under there and got out a pint of white moonshine whiskey. And she poured out two cups of whiskey. And I thought, now, she must be mighty thirsty. And then it dawned on me, she going to ask me to take a drink. Now, I ain't never drank no white whiskey. I ain't about to. But these things began to float through my mind, should I, shouldn't I? And the convincing factor was, she stuck that whiskey out, and I looked at her. She's beautiful. And I looked at them, and I thought a little bit more, and I looked back at them again. And them told me to take a drink. I poured that Jesse down. Wumped a little bit, we sat down that well-lit parking lot, and we had two or three more cups of that white moonshine whiskey. And I can tell you, something changed. And I tell you this, my experience with women up until that night was about like my being in the Army. I had fired off a few good rounds, but I had never been in combat. We sat in the car a little bit, And then, because I got a little bit aggressive, she suggested we go in the dance. We went in the dance. The fiddle, guitar, and banjo started. She grabbed my hand on the floor. We went. I didn't hesitate one moment. We began to circle that room like other people were doing it. We do-si-do, promenade, lemonade, whatever they was doing, we were doing. The men were looking at us, and they were laughing. The women looked a little disgusted. But she had on my Ike jacket, and I can tell you, she did not have that thing buttoned up. It was stuck out just like that. Had my cap on. We do-si-do and promenade. We got to doing the bunny hop, and one of the security guys had to come over and call me down because that bunny hop come natural for me. I loved it. I got carried away, too aggressive. And I can't tell you everything that happened. This lady's here, and I'm not going to take step five up here tonight anyway, or this morning. Some things happen in my life, none of your business, and I ain't going to share it. Ain't got a thing to do with recovery. But anyway, I'm laying at home Sunday morning about 2:30 in the bed. I just gotten home, put my uniform over on the other bed, and I'm laying there fighting off sleep. I don't want to sleep ever. I just want to think about Saturday night. Every marvelous thing that had happened. The mountains I climbed, the valleys I crossed, how I'd grown up and become a man. How Mom and Dad and my preacher brother lied to me like dogs. Telling me that booze was something that would send me to hell, and I had been in absolute hog heaven on Saturday night. And I couldn't hardly wait to get back and get some more of that good stuff, all of it. I had enjoyed everything. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that come the next weekend, this old boy would be getting that magic ingredient that enabled him to feel normal, to act like other people, to be somebody, to socialize, laugh, talk, dance, and do things in spite of the moral teachings that I have had that to do certain things was wrong. The next Friday night, I bought that pint of whiskey before I got out of the city limits of Petersburg, Virginia. And I came home, and I had a ball. And had a lot of good times. In fact, it was 6 weeks before the blackouts were already coming. 6 weeks to that weekend, I went to jail for the first time for driving under the influence. And that became a pattern in my life. Going home, getting in trouble, driving under the influence, driving after license revoke. And over the next 10 years, that happened 14 or more times, driving under the influence, or driving under the influence and after license revoke. And then I'd add on a few other little things, like striking police officers, resisting arrest, and such stuff as that. An awful lot of trouble come from driving and driving drunk. And that was repeated behavior over and over again. I got out of the Army in 55, went back in 56. Not because I was patriotic. I got an honorable discharge in May of 55. In October of 56, I had a new bride, and I didn't need a new bride. I was to be a father. And I've heard recently on television that kids in the back seat can cause accidents. Well, I learned years and years ago that accidents in the back seat can cause kids. And I was to be a father. And I ran off from that. I also ran away because of other reasons. I went back on active duty, really, not because I was patriotic, but because the prosecuting attorney told my father that if I went back on active duty, that I'd never be tried on those charges. They'd not prosecute. And I had several driving charges to be tried on. I went back in running from trouble. And some several months later, en route to Korea, I'm on the ship. I'm going back in through the National Guard now with the rank of corporal. En route to Korea, I took a look at my life at the rail of that ship one morning when I'd been on the water about 8 days. I had had so much trouble since I had started drinking. And I hadn't had any trouble until I started drinking. I made up my mind that in Korea, I'll have an equal opportunity. Nobody knows me. I will not drink. I will not get in trouble. I'll just go ahead and make the Army of Korea. When I got to Korea, I enrolled in school at night. I was given a good job as an NCO in charge of a maintenance shop. Some Koreans and GIs both would be working under my supervision. And I did a good job there. I was elected Company Soldier of the Month 5 consecutive times. I was always sharply dressed. The company commander liked me because I was so sharp. I practiced military courtesy. I was doing good in school, doing good on my job. And after 5.5 months, the company commander put my name up to meet the promotion board, and I won out over 13 other people who had more time in grade than I did. I won out for the rank of sergeant. And I can tell you, at 22 years old, I was probably the proudest 22-year-old sergeant in that area of Korea. That afternoon, when we got off work, I was leaving the shower, going back down to the NCO hut. And the guys that I work with says, "You know what you've got to do this afternoon, don't you?" I said, "No." He says, "You've got to come down to the club and buy us some drinks. That's customary here in Korea." I said, "Okay, I'll be down." I had never been in the club before. And sometime after 3 o'clock that afternoon, I showed up at the NCO clubs where my friends were. And I began to watch them as they danced with the Korean girls who had the miniskirts on. They put the quarters in the jukebox. They'd buy the mixed drinks and the beer. And I sat down and watched them for a while, and I really looked at those yellow sergeant stripes that I had on and listened to the comments they were making about how well I was doing and how much the company commander and the other people thought of me. And my head began to swell up. And this illness that I have, which I did not know I had at that particular time, began to talk to me. "Oh boy, you've been over here 5.5 months now. You haven't had one beer, one drink." And when I looked at the girls in the miniskirts, I knew that I had not had anything else. And I sat there in that club and my attitude changed. I decided to have just one. And I ordered just one. And since nothing happened, I ordered just one more. Wasn't long since nothing was happening, I decided to get me a double shot of old granddaddy Coke. And after 2 or 3 or more of those, I decided I needed to go out to the village a little bit. And when we got back, I did not go unaccompanied. When we got back, we danced another number or two, a few more drinks, and then the bouncers in that club decided they had had enough of my antics. They threw me out through the screen door, didn't bother to open it, because I was drunk and disorderly. That was Saturday afternoon, within 2.5 hours after I took that first drink. Sunday morning, when I wake up in my room, I'll come to. There's 1/2 of Seagram's VO on the dresser. I reach over and I get it by the neck. I begin to drink. Monday morning, I repeat that again, knowing that I'm going on duty. And quite naturally, it wasn't long before trouble began to crop up in Korea. I was eventually court-martialed in Korea for, I call it, black marketing. The United States Army calls it stealing. I was buying cigarettes at the PX, selling them on the black market, and other little items that the village people liked. And I was selling that to make additional money to finance my drinking. And one day the warrant officer came into the shop that I was in charge of, and he was looking around. We had an inspector general inspection coming up. There were five little electrical engines made by Japanese people in that shop with no paperwork on them. And he told me, he says, get rid of those. We don't have any paperwork to justify them being here. He says, get rid of them. The papasan that was the janitor in the shop heard the warrant officer tell me that. And when the warrant officer left out, papasan came up to me and said, Sergeant, I know how to get rid of engines. And he came up with a little scheme that he would just... We would sell them on the black market. No paperwork, make a little additional money. And when it was time to take those things out to the people who wanted them, another idea occurred to me that since we're going to stick our neck out a little bit, why not include a couple of tires, fuel pump, spark plugs, some wrenches? And we did that. And papasan sold them. He started spending money and running his mouth. He got caught, and then I got caught. And I was busted from sergeant back to corporal. Very angry, very resentful, very bitter. And began to retaliate by striking out at people. And quite naturally, lots of trouble come about. I was being restricted to the company area. Sometimes when I was not on restriction, I'd go out to the village, I'd come back in drunk. I'd have the mamasans who worked in the laundry smuggle in booze to me because they wanted additional money. Eventually, I made it back to the States in 58, went home, met my little daughter by my first wife. I met her for the first time. And Mom and Dad furnished an apartment for us to live in. They loved that little girl. And I began coming home on weekends. That was in October of 58. In January of 59, I walked out of that apartment one Sunday night. Never went back into it. I knew that I couldn't be a father, I couldn't be a husband, I couldn't pay phone bills, I couldn't pay light bills. I was living to drink and drinking to live. At Fort Lee, troubles began to crop up there. Guys were complaining that I was coming into the barracks drunk, falling over footlocker, slamming footlocker doors. The mess sergeant was complaining because I'd come into the mess hall. Sometimes I'd go to sleep at the breakfast table. Sometimes I'd vomit in the floor. Sometimes the guys would get upset. They couldn't stand it. They were sissies. And they would take me to the company commander, and he got tired of it. And about this time, I had gotten another old automobile. I got a Virginia driver's license illegally, although my North Carolina and South Carolina license had already been revoked. I got a Virginia driver's license. They didn't have computers back then. And didn't check as closely as they do now. I got that license illegally, and I began to drive. It wasn't long before I was caught for drunken driving and hit and run. And before I could get that settled, I had appealed it from low court into high court. And before that trial came up, I was caught again on seven more driving charges. The company commander was really getting fed up with me. He began sending me to a chaplain for counseling. And that chaplain counseled with me for several weeks to no avail. And he recommended that I see a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist counseled with me for several weeks. It didn't do any good. The prosecuting attorney finally got into touch with the company commander and told him that in the event that Wallace is found guilty of those charges, he'll pull some time. Company commander told him to give him a few weeks. And the company commander took my record for the past 2 years and put it before a board of 12 officers. And those officers looked at that record, those drunken events and incidents. And every one of them unanimously agreed that I had become alcoholically unfit for military service. They gave me an undesirable discharge and booted me out. The next day I did go to court. I was sentenced to 90 days in the Petersburg jail on all those driving charges, fined $575 and cost the court. Well, I had the 90 days, and I started pulling that time, and I got out 57 days later because I had served as a trustee in a jail shoveling snow, cleaning the judge's chamber, the courthouse, mopping up the drunk tank, whatever, in order to get the game time. And I had already walked out a long time before on wife number one, but I had a girlfriend. And every alcoholic ought to have one girlfriend like that. She was only 19 or 20 years older than I. And she was up there that morning to get her lover out of jail. And when she paid that $575 fine cost the court, they turned me loose, and I walked out the jail, out into the parking lot where that old dilapidated automobile she was driving was sputtering, and she had every one of her grandchildren in the back seat. She came around to the front, back of that car with her arms open, and I said, "Ruth, I'll never go to another jail as long as I live." And she said, "Let's drink to it." She handed me a pint, and I hadn't seen one in 57 days, and I toasted that jail, took a couple of swigs, looked back at that jail, toasted it again, took a couple more swigs. I handed her, she spit a snuff out, and she took one. And the next morning, so help me God, Ruth was back up there to get me out of jail again. Her brother-in-law and sister had come from Washington, D.C. down to Colonial Heights, Virginia to celebrate Ruth's lover getting out of jail. Matt got caught for drunken driving that night, her brother-in-law, and I was passed out in the back seat. I couldn't even pass out without getting in trouble. But it didn't cost her but $18 the next morning to get me out. I ran from one job to another in Virginia for a year, and eventually Mom and Dad finally found out where I was and wanted me to come home, and I went home to Roxborough. I waited one day until Ruth went to work, and I got the cleanest dirty clothes that I had out of the basket, and I hit US 1 hitchhiking south to my mom and dad's home in Roxborough. And I walked in on them, and they saw how I looked, and I could see how disgusted they were at looking at me, and they told me that you can stay here, but there's no drinking. You can get your life straightened out. We'll help you. And I agreed that I would do my utmost. My cousin gave me an opportunity to go to work in the mill. He's a man that had fired me and hired me many, many times in 1955 and 56 before I went back into the Army. My cousin gave me one more chance. He was a foreman. And I went to work in that mill. I'd work from 11 o'clock at night to 7 in the morning. I'd come home to my father's home in the mornings. I'd stay around his store. I'd go with them to church some. Wife number one had divorced me, or I divorced her. I forget which way it was. Now she probably divorced me. And they introduced me to this lady that was 8 years older than I. And they thought maybe she might be my salvation. And she began to see me, and I began to see her, and I'd go over to her house and take care of good things that Baptist Sunday school teachers need taking care of, raking leaves and so forth, and cutting grass or whatever. And after 5.5 months, she was thoroughly convinced she had me saved, and she asked me to marry her. And with 13 acres of land, nice house, nice automobile, a good job, and I got 2 pair of pants and 2 shirts. That ain't no bad deal. And I'm tired of living with Mom and Dad when we got married. 3 weeks later, we went to a dance. And I know most Baptists don't dance around home. They think it's a sin to dance. In fact, they won't even have sex standing up. They'll think somebody, afraid somebody think they dance. But she was different. Sue loved to dance. And we went to that dance that night, and I got up and tried to dance with her. And I had 9 left feet. When she wanted a do-si, I'd want a do. When she wanted a promenade, I'd lemonade, whatever. I couldn't do it. I was embarrassed. And a guy that worked in the mill with me, when Sue went to the bathroom, handed me a glass of old granddad. When Sue got back from that powder room about 15 minutes later, I was ready to dance. And we did. We had a couple of enjoyable minutes there, a couple of times. But when the dance was over that night, Sue had to wake me up at the back of the room. I had passed out at a table. And she went out the door crying and embarrassed that night. And I went out the door behind her, cursing and vomiting. And I did that an awful lot for the next year that I was in the community, that year that we were married. And many, many times during the summer of 62, I tried quitting drinking, and I could not quit for more than a day. At times, I would swear off. I would say, I'll drink Friday night, I'll drink Saturday, but not on Sunday. No way will I drink on Sunday this week. I am going to work Monday. And Sunday morning, after having been drunk Friday night and Saturday night, I'd come to and then fight off taking a drink. And around 8 o'clock, I would have to give in to the pain. I had to have something that would get that washing machine out of my stomach, that churning, that gnawing, that trembling, that headache, that throbbing that was going on in my head. I rationalized, I'm going to take just a small one at 8 o'clock. And I take that small one at 8 o'clock. And then 20 to 30 minutes later, there would be a need for another. And you know what happened. At 10 or 11, 11:30 Sunday night, I'm calling a taxi to bring more booze to the house. I absolutely could not stop. I could not stop. And Mom and Dad prayed for me. They had the preacher pray for me. They put the oil on me one time. They thought they had me saved one morning about 1 o'clock. And evidently I thought so too, because I told them that I was. They said, I don't remember it, but I was drunk before 12 o'clock the next day. January of 63. I had gotten off work at 2 o'clock one Friday afternoon, and I began drinking beer at the beer joint there near my home. And I don't recall going home Friday night. I have some vague memories about Saturday morning. I don't recall going back home Saturday night or Sunday night. I don't have any memories of Sunday at all, other than just for a little bit of being at the golf course and it was pouring down rain and I was drunk. But Monday morning, my wife called me and asked me, was I going to work? And I said, yes. She really had to shake me hard. When she went back into the kitchen, I turned to the right to go into my bedroom door, our bathroom door. My elbow hit something on the pillow. It was hard, it made a clanging noise, and I raised up the pillow to see what was under that. And it was 2 pints of white moonshine whiskey on that pillow. And I sat down on the side of the bed that Monday morning in my underwear and began to drink that white whiskey and chase it with a cigarette. And she came in the room in just a few minutes to see why I did not respond to the aroma of bacon and eggs which she was preparing in the kitchen. When she saw me drinking that white whiskey that Monday morning, She went into a tirade as she had never done before. She had reprimanded me and chewed me out and called me some names many, many times during the previous year. But this time I can tell you, she did not sound like a Baptist Sunday school teacher. This time she sounded like she was straight out of the pool room, and I knew she meant precisely what she was saying. She was telling me that basically I was a sorry, no good, low down SOB of a drunk, that this was all I'd ever be, no good to her, to my family, to my daughter by my first wife, no good to my employer, no good to anybody. And she said that when she got home from the meal that afternoon after 3 o'clock, that she wanted me out of her house, out of her heart, out of her life forever. And she went on to work that morning. And apparently I sat there that morning and drank that white whiskey, and I don't recall leaving home that morning. And what I'm telling you now is hearsay. What I had to read about in the papers, or what I had to listen to on the radio sometime later. But apparently late that morning, I went down to the beer joint, bootleg joint nearby, stayed there a while, and then called a taxi and went to town. Later on, I heard some folks testify at a trial that they would not serve me beer in Roxborough on Court Street that Monday afternoon because I was drunk. I heard a sheriff testify that he had looked out his window and saw me on the street at 4 o'clock and that I was drunk and that he was coming out to arrest me, but said no one was in the office with him at the time. The telephone rang. He answered the telephone and stayed on the phone for about a minute. And when he came back to the door to see where I was, he didn't see me. And folks, I've wished a million times that he had seen me that Monday afternoon or arrested me that Monday afternoon, because offenses were committed within the next couple of hours that brought about my arrest again the next morning. And this time, no bond was allowed. I was placed in jail on the top floor, isolated from other inmates. That was January 21st of 63. On February the 11th, in Superior Court in Roxborough, North Carolina, with no defense as a result of having been in a blackout, I stood in Superior Court as that judge listened to the evidence in the case. Mom and Dad had paid $500 for a lawyer, and he couldn't defend me. He says, we'll have to stand mute, listen to the evidence, and just suffer the consequences. And we did. I suffered the consequences. After the judge listened to the evidence, he told me to stand, and the lawyer had to help me to my feet because I knew what was coming. And he says, young man, for the offenses committed, says, I hereby sentence you to the North Carolina State Department of Correction for a period of 40 years and then natural life at the expiration. Take him out of here, Sheriff. And it was 2 days later, handcuffed and shackled between two other inmates, I was taken into the walls of Central Prison. And that Wednesday afternoon, as I was standing in the back hall of Central Prison, I saw a clock on the wall in front of me as they were taking the shackles off my ankles and the handcuffs off my wrist. The door on my right-hand side slammed shut. I had never been in prison before. I had been in jail many, many times overnight. I had pulled that 57 days of a 90-day jail sentence in Petersburg, and I had never experienced anything like this. I did not know what to expect. But from the bottom of my heart, I can tell you when that door slammed shut and I stood within the confines of that prison, a feeling of relief absolutely come all over me as I stood there. Because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, this old boy was exactly where he belonged. I had lost my right to live in a free society. I did not belong out there with you people. I knew I was where I belonged. And I knew also that Mom and Dad and my other loved ones that I had remaining would know where I was forevermore. I knew also that I would never have to drink again. I would never have to experience the insanity that I had gone through in my drinking days. Because there's not supposed to be anything to drink in a prison environment. And I went into that prison environment. Within 3 or 4 days, I stood before a classification committee. And the associate warden of that institution looked at my commitment papers, 2 of them. One committed for 40 years, the other one for natural life at the expiration. And he says, "Fella, if you ever have any hope of getting out of this place, you're going to have to be a good boy." I'd only been in there 3 or 4 days, 5 days maybe. And I knew I was going to be a good boy because I didn't like that environment. I hated everything about it. I was determined that I was going to be a good boy. And I was given a good job in the classification section as a clerk because I was a good typist. And I went to work in that classification section, and I immediately started getting into trouble after other inmates took me into their confidence. When they found out I was going to be an okay guy, they told me how that I could get little bottles of alcohol that was being smuggled out of the prison hospital. They introduced me to people who were selling other stuff that was being smuggled into the prison environment. And I began to get drunk there in Central Prison. This was the only way that I could escape from that place. I was sentenced to 40 years plus natural life, and this is my doom forevermore. This is what I've got to contend with. And it was hard to face. I could not escape except by putting those things into my system, which enabled me to sleep. And I could mentally escape. I could not physically escape. That wall was in the ground, 22 feet deep. It was 22 foot wide at the bottom, 22 foot high from the top of the ground to the top of the wall, with a 6 foot walkway on the top and little cabins around the top of that wall. There was guards up there with 30-30s and shotguns. There was also 30,000 volts of electricity on that wall. I could not escape except by taking those things into my system, and I could do that mentally. This was the only way I could find relief from the torment that I was going through. In June of 63, I got fired from that job. I was sent to the print shop to work. You can bet your butt they didn't send me home. I went to the print shop to work. Also in June of 63, I attended a crazy meeting they had there at Central Prison called Alcoholics Anonymous. Also in June of 63, when my wife got home from work in Roxborough one morning, a guy was in the house waiting on her. She was assaulted. She was robbed and kidnapped. I was notified about that in a few days. And I used that excuse of being nervous and upset to go to the doctor. And he legally wrote me a prescription for medication. And I could carry that prescription in my pocket. And they could not lock me up for being drunk because I had already been locked up several times while I was already locked up. And I could carry that paper in my pocket. I used it as long as I could. In September of that year of 63, They came out on the yard, looked me up, and found me and carried me to death row and locked me up on death row. And I didn't know why they were putting me there until they got me locked up. And they said, "We have just brought that guy in that assaulted your wife. And we thought maybe you might want to talk with him a little bit." And they were right. I would have liked to have talked with him a little bit. But anyway, they locked me up on death row. I stayed there 40 days and 40 nights. During that time on death row gave me chances to think. I knew that when I got off of there, I was going to straighten up. I had perfectly good intentions of leaving that stuff alone. When that 40 days was up, and that is just by coincidence, when he was on a bus en route to another prison facility, they let me out off of death row, and I went back to the yard, the cell block, and went back to work on my job. When I went out on the yard, I had good intentions of staying straight. Within 2 hours, I was under the influence. That was in October. I continued to do that until February 16, 1964. I would go to that 1AA meeting a week. I sat in the back of the room. I didn't participate. I didn't help set up. I didn't read the literature, the pamphlets, the books, anything. Getting drunk every opportunity I had. No program of recovery. Not being able to stay as drunk for as long as I wanted to stay drunk. And yet I couldn't recover because having your name on a group prison roster, sitting at the back of the room, not practicing the program, does not provide sobriety. February 16, 1964, I was writing my precious mom a letter while I was sitting in the prison library. And it was a meaningful time for me. Having the chance to write Mom, I was always telling her how sorry I was, how much I loved in spite of the things that had happened. And I was writing that letter. I'd finished 2 pages of a 3-page letter, and I had not taken anything for several days. I was going through one of these dry periods again. And a so-called friend came in and gave me a couple of capsules, and I took those. And within 20 minutes' time, completing that letter to my precious mama was no longer important. I tore it to shreds. I went out behind the prison chapel where I had some round prison plastic dollars buried in the ground. And I dug those up and I went to the bootlegger. That night, sometime after 8 o'clock, I came to in my cell block way up on the 4th floor. It's 40 feet. From that catwalk down to the concrete floor below where guys watch television on that bottom deck at night. I came to that Sunday night in my cell block alone. My cellmate was in the hospital with a virus. And that Sunday night I took a look at where I was in life. Here I am in Central Prison with 40 plus natural life. I don't have a future. No way will I ever get out. Nobody will ever go to bat for me at the way I'm conducting myself. I can't get sober, and I can't get as drunk as I want to. I can't take it any longer. I hated the guards, the food, the clothing, the noise, the odor, the hostility, the hatred. It was hell. I couldn't take it any longer. And I made up my mind that night, knowing that this cell block door will open tonight at 9 o'clock, knowing that those guys downstairs who are wanting to come up to the cells can get in at 9 o'clock, that door will open. If you don't come in at 9 o'clock, you stay on the bottom floor until 11. I knew that when that door slid open on that row of cells that night, that I was going to step out onto the catwalk. I was going over that railing 40 feet below and end my wretched existence. The world would be better off. I would be better off. I would escape that torment and hell. And I reached upon the pillow and took everything that I had. And I chased it down with water and drank that alcohol. and I stood at that door waiting. And y'all can call it whatever you want to. Luck, coincidence, or what have you. But I believe that it was the amazing grace of God that gave this alcoholic one more chance at life. I came to sometime later, well past 9 o'clock that night. There was a row of vomit from that door, 6 foot back to the commode. My head was in the commode. I was on my knees. I was choking, crying, and gasping. And I passed out again with my head in the commode. I came to later on and crawled into the bed. The next morning when they were yelling in my cell block for me to get up, go to breakfast, go to work, I went out of that cell block, and the guys in the cell block on the right of me and on the left said, "What was going on in there last night?" I said, "What are you talking about?" They said that last night you cried out real loud for everybody along here to hear what you said. You said, "God, if you help me get back to AA, I'll try." Folks, I no more remember saying that than you do. But those guys had no reason whatsoever to fabricate that story. I can tell you this, that the following Thursday night, when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at Central Prison, the one meeting they had a week, when I walked in the doors that Thursday night, I did not go to the back of the room. I came up front. And I was already experiencing a gift from God. When I walked in the room that night, I had a gift of desperation, absolutely desperate to do something about my life. And I began to get active in the group, stayed in for 18 years, 1 month, 26 days, and 2 hours, and stayed sober from then on until this very moment. The first year, Mom saw me. When she'd come to visit, my pupils would be big. Sometimes they'd be small. Sometimes I'd have slurred speech. But Mom saw me get sober behind the walls of Central Prison. When I went to her bedside in 1971, when they signed me out and let me go to her bedside where she was dying of cancer, Mom asked me to do her a favor. That Wednesday night, 2 nights before she died, she asked me, would I always stay in Alcoholics Anonymous for her? And I said, "Yes, Mom, I will." That was in February of 1971. And here it is, 2007, her baby boy Wallace is still in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not... It's not because of the promise I made to Mama. It really isn't. I'm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous today because of promises. Because every one of them on page 83 and 84 of the B book has been a reality in my life for many, many years. I did stay in a long time. I divorced wife number two while I was in prison. She had the opportunity to see me and listen to me when I was taken out of the prison unit to speak at some AA meetings. When it eventually became apparent that I would be getting out someday, she says, "I'm glad that you've got to have the possibility of getting out someday, but says you're going to have to give up that AA thing when you get out because it's of the devil, this occult." And says, "When you get out, you can go with me to church and we can have a good life." I said, "Sue, Alcoholics Anonymous has done something for me, my preacher brother, my mom and dad, you, nobody else has ever been able to do." I said, "It's given me a way of life whereby not only have I lost the obsession to drink, I have become absolutely joyous, happy, and free. And if you think that Alcoholics Anonymous is of the devil, you go to the devil." If you don't divorce me, I'll divorce you. I divorced her while I was in prison. And later on, after that divorce, I met and married a lady while I was still in prison. And we've been married, or will be married, 28 years this coming May 26. Talked with her last night. She's waiting for me to come home. I have a marvelous way of life today. I went to work on work release in 1973. I retired from the phone company in 93 after 20 years. Bobby Jean and I were married 3 years before I got out. The Department of Correction gave me permission to build a home in last year that I was in prison. Never heard of that before, especially since my time had not been commuted. I asked for permission to have that home built, a guard says, "What you going to do with it?" I says, "I'm going to live in it someday." And he didn't know the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that I serve today. And he sort of laughed. But it became a reality, because in 1980, a male member of Al-Anon that was coming to the group that I was taken out to some, took an interest in me, and he began to get letters signed from all over North Carolina. Over 500 people wrote letters into the governor's office and parole board. People who had heard me in church groups and had seen the little dog that I had trained to put on shows for kids and so forth. They saw me, they knew me, they were around me. And the people in Sanford said, "We would be delighted to have Wallace as a member of our community." And Governor Hunt believed all those people and commuted all of that time down to 35 years where I could be paroled in 1981. In 86, I got that parole paper. One evening when I went home from work, stopped at the mailbox, walked up the driveway reading this letter that had come from the parole board. My wife saw me crying and she says, "What's wrong?" And I says, "Read the letter." But there's one thing wrong on that letter. And she began reading it. What the letter was saying was, "Congratulations, Mr. Bryan. You have completed your obligation to the state of North Carolina. You have done it with dignity and respect. You are a citizen of the state of North Carolina again. You are a free man. Congratulations." And I told Bobby Jean this one statement on that paper that seemed correct. I said, "This paper does not make me a free man. This paper is setting me loose, free of supervision by the parole department." I said, "God in His infinite mercy, back in the walls of Central Prison, when I worked that process of recovery that we talk about, the 12 steps, after I had worked 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, God in His infinite mercy removed that obsession I had to drink. And I've been out since 1981, happy, joyous, and free. The only time I go back to jail is every Wednesday night. I go to Morrison Correctional Center the first and second Wednesday night of every month. The third Wednesday night of every month, I go into Central Prison, my old home group. The fourth Wednesday night, I go to the Sanford Correctional Center, the group that I started in 1971 when I was transferred from Raleigh up there. Yeah, I go back to prison, but it's to carry the message. And today, I'm still proud to announce that I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I work the program. I'm enjoying a life that I never, ever thought possible. And it's because of people like you, people who cared enough that they brought the message of recovery into me while I was locked up, hopeless, helpless, nowhere to turn. Somebody came in and showed me that there was a way out a way out of the hell, the torment that I was in. And not only a way out, but a way to stay out if I would continue to follow and live by the principles of the program. And that's why I hope always and believe always that I will continue to celebrate this miracle, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not me.